As you meditate, bring the attention into the heart, into the core of your being, and feel what is most real within you. And feel whether you can be vulnerable enough to open the heart completely. And to know yourself completely. And to live in the truth of yourself completely. Feel what it is like to empty out completely everything that is not real, everything conditioned, acquired, given by others, imitated from others, to let go of the larval stage of the ego and the stage of imitation of the other's demands as to what life is about and how you must obey. Can you let go of all of those commands of the superego, of the social big other, and of the censor within the ego's core, to know what is forbidden to know, and to be free of being possessed by an other who gave you birth, raised you, brought you into this world, but never knew you. And feel what it is to be completely empty of the impermanent, of the unreal, of the imaginary, and of language, and to abide in that supreme intuitive knowing that is always in a state of clear, luminous serenity. And whatever chains keep you in some fixed, limited state. Whatever imprisonment in belief systems and attitudes and ideals that are not your own. Can you feel what it's like to be completely free? Completely in the present, without traces of past or of worry or of calculation or of concern for how you look to the other. And can you be fearless in the face of life and of death? Can you be open-minded to continually learn and grow and discover more of the ultimate nature of the supreme reality that you embody? Shiva. Allah. Buddha. Tao. Shiva Nama. Om Shivaham. Om Tat Sat. Namaste. One of the characteristics of society in Kali Yuga is that it cannot tolerate its own sages. It kills them. This began very early in Kali Yuga, and we have many recorded events of that type. Probably the most famous in the West is the execution of Socrates. The Athenian government could not tolerate his freedom of thinking, his willingness to overturn reified concepts and make the truth of the ideals of freedom and real democracy, not representative democracy, a fact, and the society had to eliminate him because, as they say, they said he was corrupting the youth, corrupting them by freeing them of their tendency to blind obedience and instead their willingness to learn to think for themselves under the tutelage of the Socratic method of clear critical investigation of reason itself. And so it was a great strike against intelligence. And of course, the death of Rav Yeshua in ancient Israel, but much later, 400 years or so later, was another strike against the freedom of spirit that Yeshua and his wisdom school represented. But what's important to understand is that the real Antichrist became Christianity itself, which could not tolerate the teachings of their own founder, and they banned the original Gospels. And if there weren't one set that had been buried in a time capsule in Egypt and discovered only in the 20th century, we would never know the actual teachings of the wisdom school that Rav Yeshua was the founder of, but in which there were many other sages, including Mary Magdalene. And the truth of having a female sage was even more intolerable. Later they murdered another great female sage, Hypatia, who was the great leader and one of the great scientists, but the leader of the Christian community in Alexandria later. And of course they murdered many of their own sages all through Christian history. The Muslims did the same. They murdered sages like Al-Halaj. They murdered Surawardi. We could go on. There were many others less well known. And so a civilization requires sages at the beginning, but they become a real nuisance after the bureaucratic ego structure takes over, and then they can no longer cope with a new dispensation of the truth that corresponds to the kinds of inhibition of freedom that are imposed in the new civilization that is based on the signifiers of the teachings but not the signified. And so in Christianity, a set of Gospels written 100 years later by people who never knew Yeshua or the real teachings became the new canon, but it was a pseudo-canon. And in the same way, you have many writings that were false and falsely attributed to beings who were misnamed. that were ideologically placed to support the power structure. You had the same kind of a situation in every culture. And so the wisdom schools that were in the beginning the core of a society eventually were marginalized. And in the same way that the yogis had to go into the forests and up into the mountains in order to maintain their freedom. And eventually the wisdom schools themselves had to form their own separate communities that became the ashrams and the monasteries. But in a healthy society, an ashram wouldn't be necessary. The whole society would become an extension of the wisdom school. But that was no longer able to be the case. In China, you had the great wisdom schools of Taoism and those that developed the I Ching and the various original ancient Chinese wisdom that eventually also became suppressed and replaced by the Confucian schools, which used the same signifiers. The word Tao was the core of the Confucian school, but there the Tao was the Tao that supported the social propriety. It was no longer the Tao of the absolute. It was no longer the Tao that could not be named. But now it was given a name, and the name that Confucius gave it was Ren, which the later became Zen. It was a word that was the principle of appropriate behavior in relation to a social hierarchy, regardless of whether that hierarchy was legitimate from a spiritual perspective. So you had a great deal of tension within the Chinese culture that was already thousands of years old during the Middle Ages of Europe. But interestingly, it was during that period in the 600s when a new dispensation arose, which was the Islamic civilization. And in the beginning, the Islamic civilization also produced a huge number of sages, like Ibn Arabi and Ibn Rushd and Avicenna and Ibn Sina and later, of course, Rumi and all of the Sufis that were responsible for a very electrifying return to the truth of non-duality within Islam. But then the Sufis became very intolerable to the legalists, the ones who felt that the Sharia law of the Quran had to be interpreted in accord with the needs of the political and military structure, and that the development of power required a weaponization of the intelligence, and no longer were they interested in raising mystics and beings who felt like there was one universal religion in which all were together and all were one, and who could see the congruence in all of the different cultures, but they needed to feel, no, Allah is the only one and the others are infidels, and Allah can only be understood in accord with a certain ideological understanding. But what's interesting is that in the early days of Islam, its own sages spread across the world, and a number of them went to China and started wisdom schools, Sufi wisdom schools within China, and attracted a great number of what at that time were neo-Confucian philosophers and people who had an interest in an understanding of how to reform a Chinese civilization that was already in ruins at that time. The Tao, as a wisdom school tradition, had been pretty much destroyed, had to go underground. What took its place was a religious version of Taoism that was very ritualized but lost its essence. And you had Chinese martial arts schools that used the Tao for the purposes of maintaining victory in battle and in individual combat, and the whole samurai religion that later spread into Japan based on that understanding. But the larger context of the Tao was lost. However, when these Islamic wisdom schools entered China, a very interesting thing happened. Chinese, a language, uses ideograms. It doesn't have an alphabet. And so when they wanted to translate the Quran and some of the Sufi texts into Chinese, they couldn't do it. They couldn't use the name of Muhammad, for example. There was no way to say it in Chinese or any of the names. And so the first name that they gave to Allah was Tianhu, which was the Lord of Heaven. And then they used the word Tao itself. And then in the second generation, they translated the word Allah as Buddha. And that's they literally made a congruence. Allah and Buddha have the same symbolic significance, which was an extraordinary realization, I think, that created sparked a huge renaissance, both within Islam, because it reverberated throughout the Islamic civilization, and at the same time gave new significance to the Tao and to Chan Buddhism within China. And these Chinese is the Tao of Islam, if we want to call it that, became a huge renaissance within medieval China. And until the modern period, it was one of the most powerful forces within Chinese intellectual tradition, because it was a return to the Tao as meaning Allah, as meaning God, not as the propriety of social behavior in a Confucian context. And so Confucianism itself, in a way, was reborn through this impregnation with Sufi mystical understanding that the purpose of human development and learning was to find the Tao, to find the truth of one's heart, not to adapt to society, but to get society to adapt to the presence of God within the heart of each person. And this was revolutionary. And so, of course, it was attacked, and eventually it was pretty much stamped out, but you still have that kind of tension which goes on with the Uyghurs in China, who are the Islamic civilization's descendants that became a large population there. So in any case, the reason that I'm bringing this out is that we are now in a situation where we have to have a new dispensation of wisdom, of a universal nature that returns to the heart of God and enables us to embody that, because it is the fact that we have lost our heart, our real heart, that is the cause of the current situation that we are living in. There could not be the kind of deception based on fear of life and of death that is mind-controlling the population, who are trapped within a sheepish, obedient ego structure, or a violent, rebellious structure that cannot think clearly and cannot override its emotionality and cannot fully take control of civilization and make both reason and the power of the presence of God as the principles upon which a new dharma can proceed and protect people from their freedom being entirely overtaken by an ignorant tyranny that takes advantage of the dumbed-down nature of the current ego, in which the heart and the mind have both been completely lost, if not destroyed. And so it is this return to the Tao, to the real, to the truth of our being, that is of urgent necessity in these final days of the collapse of global civilization. So, all of that as a prologue to why I'm showing you another talking head video tonight. But the talking head is a very intelligent head. His name is William Chittick, and he's a man who has translated Ibn Arabi's great Sufi writings. He's translated Rumi. He's translated a great number of Sufi texts and interpreted them in a very important and powerful way that others have failed to do, and to see the subtleties of the more mystical meanings that permeate not only the Quranic texts but all of the Sufi and the Islamic texts of China. He's very familiar with the Chinese Islamic wisdom schools and their writings, which are also coming to be translated into Western languages for the first time at the end of the 20th century. So again, another one of those time capsules, like the Nag Hammadi Gospels and like the Dead Sea Scrolls and so many others, the Dan Huang Tibetan Zen texts, etc., that have given us a new understanding of what was actually being taught in those wisdom schools and how much of that wisdom we have lost, that is the cause of our emotional fragility, our fragmentation, our inability to download our buddhi, our total intelligence, and to embody our real self today. And if we don't overcome that defect, then we are doomed. So this talk that he is giving is, I think, a very insightful one that has a great deal of intensity of presentation that brings us to the heart of what a wisdom school is about and why learning is so important. But what we are to learn is not facts and figures and theories and formulae, but to learn to touch the intense energy of the real self within us and not draw back because we can't handle the vulnerability to that much bliss, to that much understanding, to that much freedom, to that much power that causes the ego again to shrink itself down into a manageable size where it can be a slave to the other and to its own internal superego. So this, I think, is the key point that is required if we are to grow beyond the limitations of the ego larval stage of consciousness. And now is the last moment in which that metamorphosis can still take place. So I hope you enjoy the lecture and that it helps you to find your lost heart, if it's still lost, and to open it and realize the treasures of divine consciousness that are within you and all of the latent powers that are waiting to be activated as the siddhis of your eternal, infinite divine nature. And I hope you take advantage of the grace that the Supreme Lord of Heaven, the Buddha, Allah, is offering to us now and in every moment to fully awaken to the liberating truth. Namaste. Namaste.